Welcome, everybody. We are actually expecting a couple more people, but we will give it a start now. We've got a couple of people who've come from a long way away to join us tonight, so we will start. I'd like to welcome you all today, and in the first instance, I'd just like... Oh, we've only just started. Please don't creep in. Besides which, we really want to tell you that you're a bit later than you should have been. Yeah, but you're creeping in. I'm Lee Svensson. I'm the National Co-Convener of Emily's List. I'd like to ask Pamela to acknowledge country before we start.
Te ngata, Pamela, yori yora, ganakanai winya. Hi, my name is Pamela, I'm a yori yora and ganakanai woman, and I'd like to acknowledge the lands of the people that we're meeting on today, the elders, past, present and emerging, and these lands are the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Thank you.
Thanks, Pamela. It falls to me to give you a snapshot of who we are. We all know Emily's is early money is like yeast. It makes the dough rise. We started in Australia in 96. It was an instant. It took about 4 years for Leonie to gather around her Candy Broad, Kay Setchers, Joan Kerner, for them to push forward and put together and start, build a support base to make this a reality. In 94, so before we started, ALP had actually passed an affirmative action rule in relation of to have 35% of winnable seats held pre-selected for women by 2002. What happened in relation to that was that it resulted in the next election with a lower number of women being selected. I guess a lesson I think that comes out of that is ignore us at your peril. And that's been obviously something that's just been shown out in the recent elections, let's face it. Those women knew that something further than just an affirmative action rule needed to be done, and Emily's List was born. They were far-sighted women. They are our forerunners. They were wonderful, and some of them are here tonight to join us. They ensured Emily's was outside the ALP. It wasn't part of it. They didn't want to be run or cede control to the organisation or for the dollars that Emily's raised to be determined in terms of what would happen with it by the ALP, which of course was dominated by the men. They wanted an organisation run by women, for women, one that functioned on feminist community organising principles. We remain committed to those principles today, despite my desire to be a benevolent dictator, I might say, which I think is very sad. I think it would be quite good, really. My mother kept saying, telling me that. Our goals to elect more women, a minimum of 50% to all parliaments and in all houses. We support those women who are committed to our principles, to choice, equal pay, early childhood education and care, equity and diversity. Our endorsed candidates sign a pledge to support and foster those goals once elected. While we look at the number of women candidates elected, which now sits at more than 300 in the 25 years that Emily's has been going. To our parliaments, just recent federal election, those numbers, I think it's 307, but you have to go through a couple of things to try and get all the numbers, and I'm not 100% sure of that. In this federal election, we saw 8 new Emily's List candidates. 3 in Western Australia, Tanya Lawrence, Tracy Roberts, and Zanetta Matarinas, and I probably have pronounced her name incorrectly. That'd be just like me. Emily, Mary's looking at me. She probably knows how to pronounce it. In the Northern Territory, Marion Skimgrau was elected as the member for Wurundjeri. Previously, she held the chief ministership of the Northern Territory, so she's not inexperienced member of parliament, but it's wonderful to have her, and she's the first First Nations person to represent Wurundjeri. In South Australia, Louise Miller-Frost was elected, took Boothby. In Victoria, Karina Garland and Michelle Anandaraja were elected, and then Michelle holds Higgins for the first time for Labor ever. We're also likely to pick up a third Senate seat in Western Australia. Western Australia has shocked us all. They went completely red, just about. They're wonderful. So Fatima Payman may well join the Senate from West Australia. She looks very likely to be the person that does so, which is just fantastic. But numbers are not the only measure of our success. Choice is really important. It's one of our fundamental objectives. Abortions are now legal in all states and territories. All states and territories also have safe access zones. Those things are really amazing achievements. Our diversity has increased significantly this election, and it's women who actually are the main carriers of our diversity, if you like. We do have some wonderful men as well. We have a ministry now that is 43% women. Damn, not quite 50, but we'll get there. And then we'll take over. We have the very first Indigenous Minister for Indigenous Affairs. We have the first Muslim ministers in Anne Ali and Ed Husic. Our cabinet and our parliament comprise many ethnicities, my goodness, I can't get the word out, beliefs and genders, and it's wonderful to see. And if anyone was watching the swearing-in ceremony, from affirmations to oaths, were sworn on Bibles and Qurans. And it's really fabulous to see that we now are getting closer to representing the community that is our country. The ALP has committed to removing barriers to equal pay. This includes having what they'll call a pay equity panel in the Fair Work Commission, and making equal pay a basic objective of the industrial relations legislation. No, it's not at the moment. Emily's has been the force behind these things. Oh, I left out accessible ECEC. That's nothing minor. That will be a major thing for us in terms of the money and the availability of early childhood education and care for parents across Australia, but particularly women. We've been the main force behind that. Emily's, you, us. Our endorsed candidates have supported or initiated legislation to see these changes, and they have pushed through the changes in terms of the changes to the ALP policy. Abortion is to be made available in all publicly funded hospitals. It wasn't talked about really in this election, but it remains ALP policy, and they intend to push forward with that. That'll make choice more than a technicality, which it currently is in many places. So Tasmania has no abortion availability, public availability at all. And women during COVID in Tasmania were essentially unable to get an abortion because they couldn't get interstate. It's not really available anywhere out of the south east Queensland coast in Queensland. That's not acceptable. Abortion might be available legally, but it needs to be more than a technicality. It needs to be a reality. While our tagline in relation to making money and providing early money to our candidates is still an aim of ours. We're also focused on more than that, supporting, mentoring, education, and mobilising forces to get them out into the election campaigns to support the candidates that we've endorsed. Equality and equity are not the same. Sometimes we have to provide different treatment for individuals or groups to ensure they achieve equal access. You remember the cartoon, you know, everybody standing on the flat, can't see over the fence, and you give everybody an equal step and one person can see over and the second barely and the third's too low, and you give them three different steps and they can all see over the fence. That's the difference. That's the difference that we have to remember. Affirmative action is one of the mechanisms to provide different treatment to more marginalised groups and thereby move towards equality. Our panel today is going to be talking about affirmative action and its aims and intents. What's the difference between targets, quota, and merits? So I'd like to introduce them to you. Sitting first just beside me here is Jenny Beecham. Do you want a phone number? No, probably not. Jenny has a very long history with the labour movement. She's worked on equal opportunity since 1977, when she was a member of the Premier's Committee on Equal Opportunity. Jenny was the electorate assistant to Joan Kerner from 82 to 84. From 84 to 89, she was an ALP organiser with the responsibility for the Working Party on government administration, including day-to-day liaison with the state government cabinet, caucus and advisers, and state women's coordinator. From 89 to 90, Jenny served as policy coordinator to the Premier's office. She is a former Labor State Secretary from 90 to 94 and was an ALP... Is that right? Yeah. it was a very...
The first woman. Who was elected by the membership.
Oh, awesome. Of course.
One was imposed by the National Executive.
She was ALP candidate for Ballarat in 96. She is a pioneer of Emily's List, along with her good friend Joan Kerner. From 2003 to 2007, Jenny was trustee of the Queen Victoria Centre, which is where our office is housed, with responsibility for administering the centre for the benefit of women of Victoria. Jen completed her PhD at Federation University, History of Ballarat's Trades Hall. It's a beautiful Trades Hall. If you've ever been to Ballarat, go and see the Trades Hall there. She's a mother of four, a grandmother of eight, and a great-grandmother of three. The awesome Jenny Beecham. Candy Broad is an independent trustee director of First Super, ministerially appointed director of Goulburn Ovens Institute of TAFE, and board director of Gender and Disaster?
Yes.
Is it actually Disaster? Yes. I thought it was... That's wonderful. Gender and Disaster Australia. Candy has previously been chair and board director of Women's Health Victoria, board director of Australian Council of Superannuation Investors, chair and board director of PrimeSafe, a Victorian statutory authority, board director of Haven Home Safe Housing and Homelessness Service, chair and board director of Safe Steps Family Violence Response Centre, and board director of Hepburn Community Wind Farm. She hasn't been doing much. Candy was a Victorian government minister for 7 years. The total of 15 years parliamentary experience as a member for Northern Victoria and a member for Melbourne North. Her ministerial portfolios included housing, local government, energy, and Resources and Ports. She was Assistant National Secretary of the ALP prior to her election to the Victorian Parliament in 1999. She has previous experience as an advisor to the Victorian Government and Chief of Staff to the Premier of Victoria. Candy is a graduate member of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, a graduate member of the Australian Institute of Superannuation Trustees, a member of Women in Super, and a founding member of Emily's List Australia, which we think is really important.
So do I.
That's good. Candy holds a Bachelor of Commerce from University of West Australia because she hasn't had anything to do in her life at all. She lives in regional Victoria. Welcome, Candy. Tanya Kovac, our wonderful Tanya, previous, I don't know if this is down here, but I'm going to say it, previous national co-convener of Emily's List, who I can only hope to partly live up to. She is currently the CEO at Gender Equity Victoria, the state's peak organisation for gender equality organisations, practitioners and advocates. She trained as a lawyer, spent 10 years working on high-profile human rights cases, including for women victims of police misconduct. Acting for Amnesty International in the cases concerning refugees aboard the MV Tampa. I left the ALP over the MV Tampa, I had to come back. And supporting victims of the Black Saturday bushfires before leaving the law to manage small gender-focused NGOs. She was Chief of Staff to the late Fiona Richardson MP, Australia's first Family Violence Prevention Minister, where she was responsible for delivering family violence reform in the wake of Luke Batty's death and the innovations in gender equality, including Victoria's first gender equality strategy. Tanya is a Senior Research Fellow for Gender Equity at Per Capita, and a former executive officer and national co-convener of Emily's List Australia. Of course, it's in here. Why would I think it wasn't? She was instrumental in achieving gender targets for women in politics. 40% is not equal. I'm voting for 50% was the cry in 2014. So I was thinking of that conference itself, but was that 2015, the conference itself? Yeah. And it was that particular billboard that we had that was so fabulous at that state conference, I remember. I think it was the national conference, actually. I've got COVID brain and I haven't even had COVID. Maybe it's menopause. Tanya is also a writer and poet, with her work featured in The Age, Daily Telegraph, Crikey, Overland, Mamma Mia, and more. Welcome back. Pamela, as you know, is a proud First Nations woman with ancestors from Yorta Yorta and Gunai Kunai mobs. Pamela has 20 years' experience in financial services sector, working with various roles in mid-sized and large corporates. In 2013, Pamela successfully completed the AMP Horizons program. In 2016, she became the principal of her own financial planning business and is currently director of Audicott Partners. She has formal qualifications in marketing and communications, a graduate diploma in financial services, and has successfully passed the FASEA exam, which I have no idea, but she might explain to us later, in 2020, and is currently completing a Bachelor of Law at Deakin University. She's a passionate and dedicated member of the Australian Labor Party. She's the current Secretary of the Vic Economic and Innovation Policy Committee, a general member of the Vic Women's Affairs Policy Committee, president of the Roeville State Branch, and was recently the campaign manager for the federal seat of Aston, which we just didn't get across the line on. She's a dedicated member and advocate of the AIOFP. Again, she might have to tell you what that is, but I'm guessing it's the Australian Institute of Financial Planners.
Close. Australian Institute of Independent Financial
Planners. Okay, all right. And the FSU. She is a member of Emily's list. Damn well, better be, because she was elected to National Committee in 2018. She held the senior positions of National Treasurer and co-convener of the Victorian ELAG. And now she's our CEO. Pamela and her husband John have two young daughters together and enjoy spending time together as a family whenever spare time, with whatever spare time they may have, which I can tell you ain't much. Pamela is going to moderate today's panel, and I'll leave it to you.
Thank you, Lee, for your very, very generous bios reading there. Thank you. So today I'm going to jump straight into it because I'm conscious that we are moving along in time. So don't believe that people who were affected by decision should be by decision should be part of making them. At a strategic level, that basically meant affirmative action, which was also Emily's list. Joan also believed everyone had a role to play. So I'm going to ask each of our panellists, what role did they play? And I'm going to start with you, Jenny.
Oh, wow. It goes back a long way. I had a really good friend in California, and she was a member of their Emily's list, and she used to send me their material. And I must say, Joan wasn't that keen on it at the start. She was a bit worried about it. And this is like... this would be 1980, anyway, in the 80s. However, because we were doing really well in Victoria, we from John Kane through his, we went from, I think it was 2 to 5 to 8 to 15 women, and we thought, oh, this is sailing along. So when it came to the crunch in 92, we were back to 5, and you realise the women were in marginal seats. And that they were, and I must say, the Liberal Party have been a bit slow because this is what's happened to them as well. It doesn't just happen by natural brilliance and merit and all those things. Women have to fight to get their spots. So that's where it started for me. It was also, Emily's List was doing pretty well in England as well at the same time. So people started to hunt around and think, well, this is not a bad idea, let's have a go at this. However, in Victoria, the affirmative action really started with, and at the national level, with the Status of Women Policy Committees, who were many of the same people who went on to Emily's List, and certainly... You know them all, you know, Julia Gillard, Kay Sitchers, all of those people, Dorothy Reading, they were all very formidable supporters of something having to be addressed. But I have got one little anecdote. The status of Women Policy Committee went to meet with John Kane because there'd been a rumour in the newspapers that we needed a minister for women. And when we went to see him, his hand shaking. I thought, geez, you're the premier. We're just a bunch of women. We're not that scary. Anyway, what I realised, he knew the other networks in the Labor Party, but he didn't know the women's network. He did, like, we were sort of just creeping along out there, and that we really didn't have to be taken account of. So this, at this point, I think he had registered this was a network he'd better hurry up and find out about. But anyway, we took him to neighbourhood houses, and the women were really nice to him, and he and Nancy really liked sort of doing that face-to-face stuff, and he was never an opponent, but his beginning reaction wasn't that enthusiastic. He was not the only one.
Tanya, can I throw that same question to you?
So I'm a part of the generation of Emily's List women and Labor women who stood on the shoulders of others who had achieved 35% and 40-40-20 in terms of the AA affirmative action target for the Labor Party and went for 50% during the years of 2014 to 2016. And what did that really mean? What did I actually have to do apart from, you know, stirring the pot with everybody at Emily's List to say this was going to be something we should all do after we'd had a couple of successive elections where we really felt like the target was not being fulfilled and that there was a bit of lip service being given to it by the factions. It meant getting down and dirty in the actual rules of the ALP. So I had to know them and understand them and be able to draft them to the advantage that you wanted to see. It meant knowing everybody and interacting with everyone in every single faction of the Labor Party. And having to have very, very intimate and difficult and challenging conversations. I made lots and lots of friends. I made lots and lots of enemies. And it also meant, you know, taking a campaign onto the conference floor and having campaign materials to support that, like you would any kind of activist style campaign, and we did that really effectively. And I worked very, very closely with Lisa Carey, who, you know, was an absolute activist champion on these issues. And we had a great deal of fun. And if you look outside there, you'll see one of my favourite photos, which is Lisa and I standing very close to former senators Conroy and Carr, who really did think that they ran the show. And there were. There was Tanya and Lisa proving that that was not going to be the case forever.
I have to say that's one of my favourite photos too. And Candy, please, what role did you play?
Okay, so can I first of all just say how terrific it is to be here with all of you in this space as part of 25-year celebrations of Emily's List. I mean, who knew 25 years ago about all the things that women were going to achieve and do for women back then. So it's just wonderful to be here.
We're happy to have you here too.
It's just remarkable when I think back, probably before Tanya was just about born. But absolutely is a great thing to reflect on. So I might just reflect on a couple of aspects of my involvement, along with so many others. And so going back to the early 1980s, which Jenny also did, before I had the good fortune to know Joan, and before the election of the Kaine and Hawke governments, I was fortunate to be welcomed onto the Victorian Branch Status of Women Policy Committee, and together with women like Dorothy Reading and many others, to be very much in campaign mode around reforming Labor's policies regarding women's reproductive rights and affirmative action. I think it's important to point out back then that affirmative action was really all about internal Labor Party elections, and that work had been going on for decades before I got involved in the policy committee. I'm thinking back to women like Sheila O'Sullivan, who were involved in national conferences and getting up those affirmative action rules. So it wasn't about affirmative action being applied to pre-selections for public office. It was about internal party elections. And in a kind of twist of fate, years later, I ended up being, I think, the first woman elected when the affirmative action rule was invoked in an election for the administrative committee at a Victorian branch party conference. Took a while for it actually to happen, but it actually kicked in. People were excluded from the count, and the affirmative action rule ensured that the remainder of the count was only between women candidates. You know, that was a big learning experience for a few people, me included, who didn't really expect to get elected. But moving ahead quite a lot of time, another terrific opportunity opened up for me when I was appointed to the Assistant National Secretary position in 1993, something that Jenny had quite a big hand in, actually. And Labor women were very much fired up around that time as a result of what's been referred to in part, seeing a whole lot of women losing their positions, both in the party and in public office, and thinking that something had to be done about it. So in parallel with a lot of work that I was involved in around the formation of Emily's List, there was, in concert with that, in the lead up to the 1994 National ALP Conference, work done around a very different version of affirmative action, which was devising an affirmative action rule for public office selection, which had three main components: a target, a timetable, and a penalty if it wasn't achieved by that timeline. And simply put, the penalty was pre-selections cancelled, they get done again by a different bunch of people, and the target gets achieved. That was a pretty big deterrent to the power brokers to disregard that rule.
So we call that the stick.
It was a stick. The it was stick. A very big stick. And it was a hell of a campaign, which so many women participated in. I couldn't possibly name them all, but it encompassed Labor Women's Conferences, state conferences, the National Executive of the party, and then finally the 94 National Conference, where that rule was adopted. Can I just recount an anecdote? So there were a lot of nervous young men at the time who believed that they had lined up a plan which would result in them getting pre-selections for seats. And I might say one of them was someone who is now our Prime Minister. He was lined up and was expecting to succeed. A fantastic woman who was due to retire, Jeanette McHugh. She was the first woman elected to the Federal Parliament from New South Wales, and she had a terrific career in politics. But through a lot of very detailed work, the sort of detailed work that women are used to having to do to convince the blokes that things can be done in a different way, and some very impressive spreadsheets, never underestimate the power of a spreadsheet, one of Jenny's team from the Victorian branch office, a terrific young bloke at the time, Andrew McKenzie, helped put together this fantastic spreadsheet which showed that those young men who were expecting to secure pre-selection for seats would be able to do it within the timetable which would see the rule achieve its goals. And so finally everybody voted for it, and so much of the division and tension which had been around for years in the lead up to that conference didn't exactly disappear, but we were able to get it through and then start building on that, because as has been explained, it wasn't a 50-50 representation rule, but it was a step along the way. So I'll stop there.
Thank you so much. And I have to say, I do love I love a spreadsheet myself, and totally know the power of that too. It can really stop people in their tracks. Love spreadsheet too. So I found an article by Rachel Power from the Sydney Morning Herald. It was called In the Feminist Legacy of Joan. And there was a fantastic conversation recorded there between Jed Keeney and Joan Kerner, where Jed was feeling a little bit beaten down. She's campaigning mode. And so she was, you know, seeking some sort of wise words from Joan. And she, in the article, it actually recounts what Joan had said to Jed. And Jed has never forgotten it. It was like, oh, for goodness sake, Jed, do you think that every man in every senior position or on every board got there on merit? And I think that's something that, you know, often we need to remind ourselves that if we're sitting there thinking that all the blokes are getting there on merit, that's not necessarily the case. So one of the arguments that's often put forward is that affirmative action and quotas, especially, remove the requirement for merit. We hear that especially from the coalition government and some other organisations saying that, you know, that's the case. So can I maybe go straight to you, Candy, and tell us, you know, does it remove merit?
Well, look, merit is, of course, important. And I had the good fortune to work with a national secretary called Gary Gray, who had a very straightforward approach to this. And he put forward the view that, well, unless you were someone in the Labor Party who believed that men were inherently a lot smarter than women, the only explanation for the fact that women were so underrepresented in the party was discrimination. And affirmative action was about setting that to rights. And if we didn't do that, the Labor Party was simply denying itself of a whole lot of talent and experience and things that women could do that were being precluded, not because they didn't have merit, but because they were being discriminated against. And you know, you can go through a long list of the tortuous ways in which women were discriminated against, and through a factional culture in the Labor Party in many respects continue to be, and that continues to be fought against. So there are formal power structures, as we all know, and rules. And then there are the informal power structures, which aren't accountable under any party rules, and where ways are found to circumvent rules. So perhaps I might hand it on, because Tanya's done quite a lot on that.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting, this merit argument. Merit means that the leadership position is deserved or earned, but there is so many ways in which you get leadership where it's not deserved and it's not earned. Nepotism is not meritocratic. Bequeathing and bequesting your seat to somebody that is your child is not meritorious. Neither is the fact that you have so much money that you can afford to pour billions of dollars into an election campaign meritorious. But we seem to be obsessed with focusing on gender equality special measures and other special measures that are supposed to be dealing with the discrimination of racism, sexism, ableism, ageism, LGBT, homophobia and anti-LGBTIQ policies. I'm always focused on, now these days when I do speak about the importance of special measures, targets and quotas, that when you have the International Monetary Fund now talking about special measures like quotas as being one of the only ways to overcome gender disadvantage, to address productivity and economic inequity across the world, you're no longer seeing quotas and targets being some kind of feminist boutique issue. You're seeing it being essential to the future economic prosperity of the world, and necessary to ensure women's ongoing participation. And I think that's one of the reasons why the coalition has sort of fallen into a bit of a heap in this election, because they just haven't followed where I think the politics are going in relation to gender equality and affirmative action.
That was perfectly said. Thank you, Tanya. Sorry, And please, Jenny.
Don't even start me on merit. I find it so offensive. But the longer the Liberal Party takes to work it out, the better. like Candy, I think what a wonderful week it's been to see that diverse set of people there in the highest positions in the federal government. And Emily's list has always known that. You can't always tell who's going to be a good Member of Parliament, actually. So it's a very hard thing, actually, to decide what is merit anyway, if you actually were going to put all the boxes over there and tick people off against them. It would be a very difficult task. And you need a range of skills anyway across the Parliament. You don't need everyone to be good at all the same things. So it's a mad idea. But when you see all those... my daughter said, those fat old men in their blue ties, like, it's a really striking image, isn't it? If that's merit, well, if that's merit, I don't want to have a part of it.
But don't you think it's also tremendously upper middle class elitist, this whole set? I mean, the whole thing is, what are we determining to be merit? Is it that you've got a university degree or a law degree, or
That's what really offended them at the 1994 conference. I went through all the politicians in the federal parliament at the time, and their similarity was staggering. Mm. Like, I think only three had not been to university. A third had a law degree. Like, the notion of that returning anything that reflected the parliament was nonsense. But merit is power. Merit's about power, and you determine it. If you've got the power, you define what merit is. But this has always struck me as something really interesting. Where I was selecting staff for the ALP, and the office manager was a terrific woman, Helen McVeigh, and she said one of the things to avoid is choosing people like yourself. That lots of them, and that's how employment choices are often made. You're comfortable with that person, they'll fit in and whatever. And it was the best advice I ever got, because you really have to look at the range of things an organisation needs, and that's what merit has been defined is as selected by the people who determine that.
No, I think that's an excellent point, and I've always been a fan of hiring people that are not like myself.
Yeah.
Because it means
a bit of Indigenous is good.
I don't know. Indigenous is fabulous. But I mean, I'm not really an admin queen. So I always like to hire people who love admin. They're my favourite people. So when Emily's list first started 25 years ago, only 14% of the ALP federal caucus were women. Today we're steadily heading towards that 50%, that elusive 50%. How do you think the impact of targets has changed the culture of politics within the ALP? And I'm going to throw our next question in on the hook of this one as well, and furthermore, the culture of politics as well. So, Tanya, why don't you go first?
Well, clearly, in the Australian Labor Party, affirmative action and Emily's list has fundamentally changed how the ALP operates. You just have to look at these, really stunning pictures over the last couple of days of what a intersectional gender equal cabinet looks like. We actually have got, people with names like Wong and Plibersek and Ali and Bernie occupying, senior positions. So I think in terms of representation, it's been incredible, and I don't think we would have the teal independence without Emily's List Australia. And so, I think the influence of the feminist project within the ALP is now being seen inevitably as a consequence for the coalition as well. Has there been profound change in the culture of the ALP because there has been a critical mass of women? to some extent, not completely. And many of you will know that I have been an outspoken person in relation to these issues, and in particular, at this point, probably in light of the findings of Kate Jenkins' investigation into the safety of federal parliament, feel somewhat vindicated for the statements that I made a couple of conferences ago about the importance of the Labor Party having a code of conduct in order to ensure that incidents of sexual harassment, sex discrimination and other things that we know take place within the ALP and within all political parties are changed. So I think it's great, and I think it's going to be superb Albanese Labor government. But I think I'm really hoping that it takes some strong steps to ensure that our parliaments are safe for all women.
I think that's perfect response there. Jenny, do you want to...
I think it's a really interesting question. Because what I still think we've got a long way to go on is looking at putting the gender lens on all policy. The Labor movement is a masculine culture still. I was so offended by that furor about saving the curtain. If you were a woman, you did not go to the curtain, see that as a safe place or a place you would want to be. And yet the masculinity of the culture still was saying, we've got to save the curtain. And I think that we've got to actually speak up, not necessarily, you know, it's not a public issue, but it is, that masculinity is still well entrenched and it has to be challenged. And Lee's just talking about the nurses' union. The nurses represent 54, or the women membership of unions is now 54%. Yet what is the image that's still portrayed of unions? It's the high-vis shirts. Where did the politicians think they had to go? They had to go somewhere where they could wear a high-vis. They would occasionally go to a childcare centre where they would try and wrangle the small children. They very rarely were seen talking to the workers in the childcare centre, in the images. So yeah, you understand some of that is optics, but it just... To me, there is still a lot of work to do on that gender analysis of all those areas. I was really... it's a long story, but sex blindness was a phrase coined by Marilyn Lake. Not necessarily coined by her, but she wrote a terrific article about the Labor movement and how... women were operating in the 1890s. There was a really strong bunch of socialist women. They were active in a whole range of ways. Violet Goldstein was one of the activists in that group. They got run over by the culture of the bushman and the mythology around the outback Clancy of the Overflow. And women just absolutely dropped off the radar in the Labor movement as in leadership roles. And they didn't come back to the 1970s. So you've got to actually understand that history, that it's not so much that the men are, and I certainly don't think this is true of younger men. The Andrew McKenzie's from that time on, they were much more alert to it. But that masculinity...
She's not that young, 60.
I know. Yeah, that's right. So it's certainly that masculinity is still sets the culture, and we have to be the ones who run the gender lens over all of it. And there's one that just struck me in the Age. They do a readers' poll, and they had one last week. Oh, the first question was, do you support the plans for Indigenous voice to Parliament? Very good. 77%, no, 14%. The next question, should Australia introduce National menstrual leave, yes, 29%. No, 39%. Unsure, 32%. And I think, well, I think that's, for a long time, women have pretended that it didn't exist in the workplace. Joan Kerner, Carolyn Holt and myself all got shocking migraines once a month, and to the point of being incapacitated. But
who cares?
No, well, you certainly didn't talk about it. You dealt with it, and you suffered through it. But it wasn't taken as a workplace issue in any way. So those are the sort of issues that we now have to, and that we have to now apply.
You're going to change that, Jenny.
I'm sure you will. I have no doubt that that's happening. But it is the next step. Is actually that it is for me. It's the gendering of the left that has to be addressed at every level, and sometimes it isn't popular, and it isn't actually even understood.
That's absolutely true, and that is something which, as you can see by the poll, is actually now starting to be talked about, which I think is good.
And I think Daniel Andrews is absolutely remarkable in how he's actually worth the putting that on.
Yeah, absolutely agree with you there. Yeah. Candy?
Well, for me, culture, one of the ways of looking at culture is that it's about what people do, how they behave. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind, having had the experience of sitting around a cabinet table, which was just one short of achieving 50% representation by women, and a majority of those women being subscribed to Emily's list objectives, because we do have to acknowledge the fact that not all women are, simply by virtue of being women, subscribed to the same set of values that we are. But being around that table in those circumstances meant that people's behaviour changed, and what was on the agenda changed, and how things got done changed, and all of that fed into having on the agenda decriminalising abortion, safe access zones, and so many things which Emily's List organised around, women in the party, policy committees organised around, and those things were made possible by affirmative action, culture change, which meant that what got done, how people behaved, changed. So, yeah.
That's well said. Thank you, Candy. Appreciate that. And our final question is, what has the critical mass of women in the ALP achieved in terms of policy change and law reform for Australian women? And I might start with you, Tanya.
Yeah. Oh, it's been enormous. I mean, I think having been really involved in family violence law reform, there is no way that that we would have the kind of investments that we've had in Victoria without there being a, not just in the Andrews Labor government, but a continuum of leadership building, of which Candy was also very much instrumental around investment in family violence work. But I think probably the thing that I'm really interested now is looking at how gender equality and the experience of special measures within the Labor Party is now transferring into public policy and law reform. So the Gender Equality Act that has been introduced into Victoria now requires 300 public sector organisations to deliver a gender equality action plan. And it is, as Candy talked about, it has timelines, it is requiring targets, it's requiring monitoring, and there's a stick, there's penalties if you don't start showing as a public sector organisation that you're engaged in transformation for gender equality. This is possible because feminist Labor women MPs have enacted that act and are now using the successful experience of special measures in a legislative and policy setting. And it is going to be transformative in Victoria and I think across Australia and then internationally. So I think that's really incredibly exciting.
I couldn't agree with you more there, Tanya. Candy, would you like to answer the same question?
Yes, thinking about the significance of the things that Tanya's talked about and what can be achieved, reflecting on a recent board meeting that I attended of the TAFE that I'm on the board of, where we very recently voted on adopting a plan under the gender equality legislation to send off to the minister for her approval, Gail Tierney, and the systematic structural change which comes from the work that women have done, that being adopted, implemented, the resources that have been put behind it, because there are substantial resources needed to achieve what that legislation aspires to. It's just a complete game change in how significant that work is. So,
no, I agree with you there, Penny. And Jenny?
Oh, I just think of so many things. When I got married, I had to resign from the education department. And then when I left the ALP, I had 17,000 in super. That's women getting super, like that was a huge change, which has certainly just all come from Labor parties over time for women. But the abortion reform, and when you see in the US how it can get reeled back and so on, it's been cemented in Australia absolutely by the women like Candy and Cheryl Davenport, and around Australia every state has had a group of women who've cemented that in. So that's huge. But I suppose mostly I just know one of my granddaughters was starring in the People's Republic of Malakuta, so so I'm pretty proud of her. But they're not going to take it like the way we did. They're not going to sit around the table and listen to sort of smutty jokes and upstaging and game playing before the meeting started so we could decide which of the blokes was in charge for the day. Those days are well and truly gone. And so I'm very hopeful that things are only going to get better. I'm sure they are, Tanya. And it's the work of you people around the Emily's List group that have been huge contributors to it, so I'm very happy to leave it in your hands.
Thank you so much, Jenny. So I'm going to thank each of our panellists. That has been amazing. Thank you for sharing your story. And you, the three of you, have been absolutely integral to the success of Affirmative Action. And we continue to fight, and we're very proud to continue towards that 50%. But I always say, why stop at 50? Why can't we have 100? And, you know, like, why not? So go big. I'm going to pass back to Lena. Thank you.
I just want to say a couple of final words. Jenny just reminded me that when I'm a qualified nurse, I don't work as a nurse anymore. I don't like patients very much, so I'm not as a nurse. I thought that was a bit of a drawback. When I trained, we had to ask permission to get engaged. No joke. I was out for the 50 days on the picket line, so it goes back a long way, but I was a more recent one. We were doing a skills forum with the then Labor opposition, getting ready for planning our policy. And we'd spent an hour talking about all sorts of boys' skills, and at one point we'd spent 20 minutes talking about 900 jobs for the next 10 years when we made train carriages in Australia, and that was really important. And finally I kind of cracked it because I also, my day job is with the Health Services Union. We represent disability workers and aged care workers. At that time in 2015, we were looking at needing, this has now gone up because we haven't met those targets, 20,000 workers per annum was what we needed to meet the NDIS and the aged care needs of this country. 20,000 per annum. We spent 5 minutes talking about it because it's women's work. Well, I cracked it, and Tanya Plibersek agreed with me, but we still went back to talking about the boys' shit because that's much more important. Those numbers are now a lot more than that, and for anybody following the news, you'd know that my union is asking for 25% for our aged care workers, which will take them up to the princely sum of about $28 per hour, most of them. So it's not, it's massive. And for us to have a government now that has promised to support our claim, won't put a figure on it, I don't blame them for that, but to support a pay rise for aged care workers and to promise to fund whatever that outcome is massive. I would like you all to thank very much our panel members. Pamela has a little gift for you.
A little something to say thank you.
But thank you for not just your time tonight, but the massive work that you have all done, and for us to now bounce off and go further. Thank you very much.